I'm Richard Hake in for Leonard Lope today. New York is the world's first vertical city. Its iconic skyline has soared even higher over the last century. On this week's Please Explain, we're taking a closer look at the tall buildings that define the modern city, skyscrapers. Joining us are Kate Asher, author of The Heights, Anatomy of a Skyscraper, associate professor of architecture, planning, and preservation at Columbia University, and a principal at Happold Consulting, and Carol Willis, founder, director, and curator of the Skyscraper Museum in Battery Park City, and adjunct professor, associate professor of urban studies at Columbia. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, we're also inviting our listeners to join our conversation. You can call us at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on the show page at WNYC.org, also on Facebook and Twitter. Well, Carol, you're in the studio with me. Let's start with you. So historically, what was considered kind of the first skyscraper? Was it here in New York?
Well, there's a big debate about where the first skyscraper was, whether it was in New York or in Chicago. And really, the term skyscraper, it's subject to a lot of interpretation, and there are lots of different definitions. But if you play the kind of word game and you say the word skyscraper to people, you close your eyes and you think of a tall, slender structure maybe pointing up into the sky, and that's really the romantic term for the tall building. There were lots of different tall buildings, and they were sort of, in the 1870s, short and squat and flat-topped. But the ones that had extended towers, like the Tribune Building in Lower Manhattan in 1875, those are the ones that got the name skyscraper.
So when was the kind of the first year that we're talking and that people started using the term skyscraper?
Again, there are lots of different ways to talk about it, but if you look back really at the best definition of a tall office building, a commercial building, because that's what skyscrapers are. They're really commercial real estate. They're buildings that are built to gain rents, to make money. In fact, Cass Gilbert said the best definition of a skyscraper, I think, which is a skyscraper is a machine that makes the land pay. And that first commercial building really begins with in the 1870s and 1880s with the concentration of populations, urbanization, immigration that really grows the business centers of cities.
And I guess the in order to have a skyscraper, the big thing that we needed first was the elevator. Is that right?
Sure, there are a lot of enabling technologies, and some of the definitions of the skyscraper focus on steel cage construction, for example. And the elevator, which was invented back in the 1850s, or was demonstrated by Elijah Graves Otis at the Crystal Palace Exhibition in the 1850s in New York, was incorporated first into the kind of multi-story commercial buildings like dry goods stores or hotels, but not into office buildings until the 1870s.
So you're saying it was used for goods before it was used for people?
Well, no, it was used for goods as well as for people in the other kinds of building types. So the office building only adopts 20 years later the enabling technology of the skyscraper. So that's a huge lag for a technology uptake. So that I think really underscores how important it is that the value of the land and the desire to be at the center of things drives rents up and demand for space in high-rise buildings.
Kate, I want to bring you in on our conversation. Talk about the first kind of builders and the architects of skyscrapers. They were all kind of in competition with one another, right?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, this is Carol's forte, so she knows the history really better than I do. But it was, you know, it was an exciting thing back in that day to be designing a building like that. I mean, these were, you know, Herculean in size and compared to what had been done before. So it was sort of an architect's dream to be able to play with this new form.
And Carol, you'd mentioned a lot of newspapers or newspaper companies were kind of the first to build skyscrapers. Why is that?
Sure. Well, in Lower Manhattan, especially around City Hall Park, there was the area.
Park Row, right? Park Row?
Well, Park Row is actually called Newspaper Row,
right.
As well as the street Park Row. And that's where the centers for media concentrated. And the demand for that space, because it was near the political power of City Hall, it was near the courts, it was near the population nexus of the Brooklyn Bridge eventually and all of the different kinds of transportation that brought people to the Lower Manhattan Center, that fueled the demand for a concentrated use of space around there. So, and then, of course, people, the different publishers began to compete with each other. So the ego does come into play, in the, certainly in the history of the skyscraper.
I mean, that, yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that egos were a huge part of skyscraper history, both in the late part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. So when people ask why so tall, a lot of it is really about ego and competition.
So it's sort of like bigger is better.
Well, that hasn't changed, has it? I mean, you know, something's never changed.
What were the challenges kind of early on to build a skyscraper? I mean, I know now we drive piles down, pile drivers drive these big, you know, things down into the bedrock. But what was it like to build a skyscraper back then?
Well, the first skyscrapers were built with horses and carts that carried great steel members to the site. They were dug with shovels and steam-powered derricks. The first elevators were powered by steam engines. So the technology was advanced for its day in the 19th century, but when we think about it in contrast to the facilities that we have today and the interior comforts that one has in buildings, these were primitive buildings that were built, first of all, with 19th century technologies.
And talk about the materials used to kind of build the skyscraper. I mean, I'm assuming some are brick, and then if we just a short walk from our studios right here in Soho, we have the kind of the cast iron district. Were those some of the earlier skyscrapers?
Well, the introduction of metal in Chicago was one of the great innovations. And in fact, they called the steel I-beams that were bolted together with rivets the Chicago frame, which is one of the reasons why Chicago has the reputation as the birthplace of the skyscraper. But some of the early skyscrapers were actually all masonry structures. And masonry can be built up to about 16 stories tall. So at the same time, contemporaneous, the steel technology was being used as masonry structures were pushed up. The problem with masonry structures is that you need a lot of stone at the base. And so the walls might be 12 feet thick. And that, of course, is taking away the rents that are available on that most valuable ground floor.
Give us an example of a tall masonry structure.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chicago is a great example because in 1891, the Monadnock Building, which is in the Loop in Chicago, was built by Burnham and Root. And it's about 16 stories tall, and it's pure masonry and very elegant-looking building when you look at it. It looks kind of Egyptoid in its style. And that very same architectural firm was building a very airy steel construction building with big plate windows and white terracotta infill that looked very lacy and very open. And they were exploiting and they were following the wishes of their clients and the kind of building technology they used.
And Kate, what are some of the other new materials and technologies that allow us to get these buildings so tall today?
Well, you know, it's interesting because they are in some ways the same core materials. I mean, the steel that really transformed what skyscrapers looked like and allowed so much more rentable space is still the core technology for most certainly commercial skyscrapers today, but there's much improved technology to make it in different grades of it, and that goes both for you know, cement, concrete, and for steel. And so it's improvements in the actual material itself that make it stronger, that make it lighter, that allow you to go taller with less of it. That has to do with cost, that has to do with the weight of the building. And so the improvements in those materials themselves, which were essentially just, you know, derivatives of those original materials, is what has allowed these skyscrapers to push so much higher. And, of course, other forms of elevator and supporting structure. But those materials really have improved themselves.
And talk about the challenges of, you know, creating the water system, the plumbing, the electrical wiring in a skyscraper. What's the challenges there?
Right. Well, I guess part of what people forget is it wasn't just the steel structure and the elevator. You needed a whole lot of internal systems in buildings to make them places that people wanted to go. You know, if you couldn't provide heating in a way, if you couldn't provide light, if you couldn't provide telecommunications, you really wouldn't have been able to communicate with people on the 25th floor. So all that infrastructure that goes into buildings today was really there in a more primitive form. And as it improved, it made skyscrapers and high floors and skyscrapers much more attractive places to work.
And I guess economically, they're pretty good for the environment because by having electricity, having to travel less of a distance, it's very practical to kind of pack people into a skyscraper, right?
It's very practical in that sense, and it's also very practical in terms of heating and the environment. And so in terms of some of the challenges and environmental things that we're concerns that we have today that we didn't have, all of a sudden people are looking at tall buildings and saying, hey, you know, density is not necessarily a bad thing. It actually, you know, cuts down on lots of things that we don't want to pump into the environment.
I'm speaking with Kate Asher, author of The Heights, Anatomy of a Skyscraper, and Carol Willis, the founder, director, and curator of the Skyscraper Museum. We're talking about skyscrapers on this week's Please Explain. And if you have a question about the history or construction of these tall buildings, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692 or leave a comment on our show page. We'll be back with more right after a break. I'm Richard Haken for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Kate Asher, author of The Heights, Anatomy of a Skyscraper, and Carol Willis, the founder, director, and curator of the Skyscraper Museum. Today's Please Explain is all about skyscrapers. And Carol, is it true, and I've heard this before, that skyscrapers sway in the wind?
Well, they certainly do. They certainly do. There are two major forces that play on skyscrapers. Gravity is one, but the one that really concerns the engineers the most and needs the most analysis and testing for super tall buildings is the wind forces, the overturning forces of wind.
And so how does it work? How do they engineer, the skyscraper to basically stay up in the wind?
Well, ever since the 1960s, and actually the World Trade Center was the first building really to be tested in a wind tunnel analysis with computers and a fan blowing about 30 miles an hour, and then the extrapolation of the forces on the surface of the building, but also the vibration of the building. So there are several different kinds of testing that are necessary, and they're done in very elaborate models in laboratories where the conditions, called a boundary layer wind tunnel labs, where the conditions of the urban surroundings play the turbulences that one finds in the city situation.
Talk about the introduction of kind of glass in skyscrapers, because, you know, if you go through the streets of Lower Manhattan, or just even if we look out the window, you know, a lot of them are that masonry material that you talked about. But then if we think of the more modern skyscraper, or like One World Trade Center, which is going up right now, and if we craned our necks around here, we could see it, it's almost all glass.
The history of the skyscraper is easiest understood, most simplistically, is kind of breaking in the middle of the 20th century, around post-World War II, when the two new technologies of lighter steel, curtain wall glass, and also air conditioning and fluorescent lights come together in order to allow for very tall buildings that are illuminated not by daylight any longer, but by artificial light. And so buildings can take any shape after that. Before that, in the era through the 1930s, the Empire State Building, windows are still operable. The daylight comes in the window, and that's the principal means by which the workspace is illuminated. So there's a really dramatic shift stylistically and technology after 1950, and that's when glass curtain walls come in. So Lever House or Seagram Building or One Chase Manhattan Plaza, that really invents the look of the skyscraper. But the idea of that look, it was really born in the modernism of the 1920s. So the dream of these crystalline towers could only be realized, that one finds in the avant-garde architects of the 1920s, especially in Europe, can only really be realized with the technology after World War II.
And talking about glass and the height of a tower, you know, there is a storm headed our way, a hurricane. Are there concerns about skyscrapers withstanding kind of high winds?
Well, the skyscrapers are tested for just these kinds of winds, and so their, you know, intention is that they are absolutely able to withstand them. The conditions where some of them haven't are really a result of usually faulty, not necessarily always design, sometimes construction, because they are designed to withstand those kinds of winds.
Let's talk about construction. I mean, the Empire State Building famously was built in record time. What was it, about 2 years that it was built?
Oh, no, 11 months
for
the construction.
Okay.
Yeah, 13 months from the foundations to topping out.
What do you have to go through to build a skyscraper? I mean, why do some take a lot less time than others? Is it just basically the way you go about it?
Well, the Empire State Building was really a kit of parts. It was a kind of erector set, different kind of technology than we have today. more primitive in terms of the rivets. It was that those members of steel were actually put together with red hot rivets that were heated in a forge and thrown across a couple of bays of a building, 60 feet or so, caught by the riveter guy in a catcher's can, and then driven with a pneumatic gun to put those members together. But ironically, that kind of construction goes up faster, rate of a story a day with the Empire State Building, than the new methods where concrete is generally poured in a heavy core, and then there's steel and other prefabricated members. But the thing that takes so long today are all the mechanical systems that are built into the building. The Empire State Building was basically a shell without all of the systems and ducting that we have that complicate current construction.
Now, when I think of a skyscraper, I always think about the spire on top. Most of them have it. Is that just because of the height? They can basically rent it out to places like here, the radio stations and television stations, to have an antenna?
Well, the spires aren't necessarily always functional. Sometimes they're part of the architecture as well, though sometimes that antenna, can be a very valuable kit, as it was on the Empire State Building has been for many, many years. But a lot of it is really about the design.
Well, the top of the Empire State Building, the mooring mast, was really a kind of insurance policy on the world's tallest building. It brought the height 200 feet taller to 1,250 feet than the 1,046-foot Chrysler Building. But really, the important difference between the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building is the overall size. Empire State Building has more than 2 million square feet in it. Chrysler Building only has 1 million. So when we talk about height, we should also be talking about scale in order to really understand the history of the skyscraper.
It also gave something for King Kong to hold on to.
Right.
Let's go to take some callers right now. David is calling from Rockland County. Hi, David. You're on WNYC.
Yes, hi. I was calling. My father's an architect, and I remember him telling me when I was much younger that skyscrapers with so many people in them, that the body heat that's generated, that they have to air condition them even in the winter time. And I was wondering to what extent that's true.
That's an interesting question.
Well, I'll get my question to answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
They do have to air condition buildings year round, but it's principally because of the machinery in office buildings, right? Not body heat.
Well, that's the same way here in our control room. We have to keep the air conditioning on basically all the time because of all the equipment generating heat. Thank you.
But the air has changed in these buildings. I mean, they are breathing edifices. I mean, fresh air comes in and exhaust air goes out for many reasons, some of which are human and some of which are mechanical, and that happens on an ongoing basis. So it is possible to think of them as, organisms in and of themselves.
Are most of the tallest buildings in the world, are they offices, or are there any residential towers that are really tall? It seems almost a little scary to kind of maybe live on the, 70th floor.
If you look at the construction over the last 10 years, since 2001, which we can think of as the 21st century, or we can think as the break point in the history of the skyscraper with the tragedy of 9/11. But if you look at the production around the world, the number of skyscrapers is burgeoning enormously, and most of that construction is in China, Asia, and in the Middle East. And there, the most typical kind of 21st century tower is a mixed-use building. So the super talls, ones that are all taller than the Empire State Building, Skyscraper Museum did an exhibition called Super Tall, where we defined 380 meters or 1,250 feet as the category of building to be a super tall. And there are 48 projects around the world today that are taller than the Empire State Building that are either built or under construction.
Is there still this need for, bigger is better? Are these organizations and architects building these buildings trying to outdo each other still?
Well, there's two different things going on. In some places, there are definitely what you might call ego or vanity projects. But you're also seeing a lot of tall residential buildings in places where you really need to accommodate all the people that are moving into cities. And that rapid urbanization means that you do need to find places for people to live, and that's particularly true in some parts of Asia that are terrifically dense. And if you don't go up, you're not going to be able to accommodate all that new population. So there's really, I think, both things going on in the parts of the world that Carol is talking about, particularly in Asia, less so in the Middle East.
I'm speaking with Kate Asher, author of The Heights, Anatomy of a Skyscraper, and Carol Willis, the founder, director, and curator of the Skyscraper Museum right here in New York City. Well, let's take some calls as well. We're waiting to hear from you as well. 212-433-9692 is our telephone line. You can also leave a comment on our show page, WNYC.org. Let's go to John calling from the West Village. Hi, John. You're on WNYC.
Hey, good afternoon. Great show. So it's time for urban myth debunking. I heard that in the top of the Seagram's Tower, I believe, or some modern Upper East Side skyscraper, there is a 40-ton gyroscopic block that keeps the building from swaying in the breezes. Or it's in the top or in the basement, but is that part of that construction?
Carol's shaking her head, so I think she might know.
Well, I'm not sure exactly which building you're thinking of or confusing. I don't think the Seagram building has a tuned mass damper, which is the kind of device that I think you're probably referring to. That's a very carefully engineered and computerized counterweight that is at the top of the building. I believe Citicorp has it, that sways in the opposite direction that the building is swaying in reaction to the wind.
Right.
Thanks.
And there's several buildings that have it, and sometimes some of them are actually, believe it or not, made out of water as opposed to just the concrete with pools of water sloshing back and forth to essentially offset the wind, as Carol mentioned.
John, thank you so much for your call. You know, we frequently think of a skyscraper going up, but I'm assuming you have to go pretty down deep to build a building like that.
Well, speaking of urban myths, I think one of the ones that it comes up most frequently that I hear is, especially in relation to New York, is that you need bedrock in order to build skyscrapers, which is absolutely not true. Hmm. Historically or today, Chicago, first tall buildings were built on mud and a special kind of foundation that was created called the Chicago Floating Foundations. Today, if you look at the Burj Khalifa, which is the world's tallest building, over 800 meters tall, 2,700 feet, 1,000 feet taller than the next tallest building in the world, it has what's called friction piles, which are just like a lot of pencils that go down into the sand of the desert, and then a thick concrete mat, and the building sits on that. So it's like you're sticking your hands into the sand in order to create a stable base through the friction of the loose substructure.
So is it a myth that basically the area where we're sitting in right now, you know, you have Midtown with its tall skyscrapers, then you go down to the, you know, West Village and Soho, and then all of a sudden Lower Manhattan goes up. It has nothing to do with the dirt underneath us.
That's right. It has absolutely nothing to do with the bedrock, but it has everything to do with urban land values and transportation infrastructure and the connections that make some places in demand and others, and regulation, municipal regulation as well, that keep some places down while others grow up, surge up.
Let us take another phone call. We'll go to Linda calling from New York. Hi, Linda. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thank you. Carol, I'm wondering if the environmental movement, the green movement, is having a major impact on the design of skyscrapers today.
Absolutely. I think it's the single most important consideration that architects, especially architects and engineers, have been now for a decade or so convincing developers, and some really pioneering developers have bet their money, put their money where their mouth is, and bet on green buildings. And this is now absolutely around the world the key consideration in the design of the newest structures. You'll find all kinds of innovations. And that's all separate from what is clear about the environmental qualities of vertical density, that when you put mass transit together with great urban spaces and you concentrate people with a high value of land, you produce a really energized urban environment and also a very efficient and environmental one.
Linda, thank you so much for your call. Kate, what are some changes that make buildings green? Can they kind of retrofit some of the older buildings? Can the Empire State Building be made green?
Yeah, I mean, the Willis Tower, which was the Sears Building in Chicago, and the Empire State Building have gone through major rehab programs to, quote-unquote, green them in the last several years, and that's partly a response to the environmental movement, but really it's a response to what tenants want in terms of moving into a building or staying in a building now. And there is a lot of rehab that can be done to buildings. Some of it has to do with windows and how, you know, how much air they let through. Some of it has to do with building systems and the actual engines that power all of the water systems and the energy systems and the lighting systems and the efficiency of those. And as the technologies become more efficient, removing those old technologies and bringing new ones in is really what helps make a building's operating costs lower and make it greener. Remember, the structure itself can last for over a century. I mean, you know, the Woolworth Building is coming up for 100 years old. But it's the building parts that want to be rehabbed and brought up to, you know, modern technology. And with respect to sustainability, all of those technologies have changed dramatically in the last couple decades. So every building has, you know, of that era has the opportunity to really redo its profile in terms of sustainability.
And Richard, you had asked about glass before, mm-hmm. and I think it's really fascinating that today one finds around the world, or one looks down at Ground Zero and sees these all-glass towers. They are floor-to-ceiling glass when you look out from the inside. They are unobstructed planes of membranes of glass. But that glass is really a kind of substrate for all sorts of films that are that environmentally make that material incredibly energy efficient. So we're able to put together this dream of a new technology with all kinds of new environmental considerations.
And in just the last couple of seconds, your favorite skyscraper, Carol?
Oh, the Empire State Building.
And Kate?
I'm with the Woolworth Building. I'm an oldie.
I'm going to go with the Chrysler Building.
Okay,
it
well,
looks
the,
like
Woolworth,
the car.
The Woolworth Building is the subject of our next exhibition in January.
Okay. Well, we will check it out. I've been speaking with Kate Asher, the author of The Heights, Anatomy of a Skyscraper, and Carol Willis, the founder, director, and curator of the Skyscraper Museum. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.